Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. There were a record-setting 577 burglaries at licensed gun shops last year. That's an increase of 70% since 2013. More than 7,800 guns were stolen in those robberies. Meanwhile, there have been several central Pennsylvania gun shops burglarized in the last 4 months, including two in Mountjoy Township, Lancaster County, and others in Palmyra and in Adams County. Why the increase in gun shop burglaries, and where do these guns end up? We'll discuss that issue and several others today with our guest, Donald Robinson, special agent in charge of the Philadelphia office of the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, and Charlene Hennessy, ATF special agent and public information officer. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
Good morning, Scott.
I'm doing well. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Special Agent Robinson, let me start with you. Before we get into the gun store burglaries, the responsibilities of ATF, What I was on your website yesterday, there probably are many, many more than most people realize, but what are the responsibilities of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives?
Sure. Well, our duties are revolve basically around violent crime that involve illegal use of firearms, arson, and explosives. So anything on the federal level involving on the gun stuff, we like to refer to it, our director refers to it as targeting the trigger pullers and the traffickers. And our efforts are to target the folks that are illegally trafficking the firearms, the licensee thefts, the burglaries that are occurring across the country. We fully investigate all of those. And then we also, we refer to it as our A&E package, the arson and explosives. We've got a lot of folks that are devoted to those efforts also. On the federal side, any bombing or explosive incident that's not related to terrorism is generally falls under the jurisdiction of ATF. And then for arsons, we have a cadre of certified fire investigators, and arson explosives groups. We have the first, actually Philadelphia had the first arson task force established in the U.S. back in the early 80s. That group is still active in Philadelphia. And so we investigate jointly with, in Philly, with the Philadelphia Fire Marshal's Office, as well as the police department, and we respond to fires jointly.
Now, Philadelphia office, what area do you cover geographically?
Sure. My division covers all of Pennsylvania. So we have offices in Philadelphia, five field offices there. We have an office in Reading, Harrisburg, and two in Pittsburgh, and a satellite office up in Erie.
Ms. Hennessy, as Special Agent Robinson was speaking about federal crimes, I don't know if we're giving an education to our audience or not, but what constitutes a federal crime or a case in which ATF would get involved as opposed to just local police investigating a case?
Sure. We work with the local police in all sorts of different crimes. Our mandate is to focus in on violent crime. So if a person is arrested on the street with a gun and that person has a felony conviction, we can then take that person federally to the federal system. Or if they have multiple convictions in their history, three or more felony convictions, that person will qualify as an armed career criminal. So they would be hit with a mandatory minimum of 15 years. That's where the federal system is really beneficial, because we have mandatory minimums for some of these criminals. So we look at the most violent on the streets and we try to target them.
So let's get back to my introduction when we were talking about the rash of burglaries, not just here in central Pennsylvania, as I described in our open, that this is something that is happening across the country, record number of burglaries, record number of guns that were taken last year. Do we know why?
Well, we've talked about it quite a bit, obviously, within the agency, and we've seen this spike over the past couple of years. As you mentioned, it's well over 500 this year, and similar numbers in 17 and at 16. To me, it's almost as if a light has gone off in someone's head. I don't know if it was John Dillinger back in the day. Somebody asked him, you know, why you rob banks, and he said that's where the money is.
I don't think it was Dillinger, but it was that era, yeah.
Right. And I think that's, you know, they're burglarizing FFLs, federal firearms licensees, because that's where the guns are. We routinely investigate straw purchasing, which is basically a person who's prohibited from possessing or owning firearms, seeks out someone to go in and do the paperwork for them, go into a shop, do the paperwork, and then they turn the gun over. So that's illegal on the part of the buyer who's falsifying the paperwork, and also obviously the final recipient who shouldn't have the guns in the first place. And I just think that, you know, while we are continuing to investigate a lot of these types of conspiracies to do that, I think some folks are also figuring out it might be easier just to, you know, I spent a lot of time trying to get, you know, a number of people lined up to buy guns for me, and when I can just drive a truck through the plate glass window of a gun store and grab what I need. So that is a big effort on our part as far as our outreach to the licensees through our law enforcement, criminal enforcement, as well as our regulatory side, the industry ops side, to reach out to them and talk to them about security in the shops. We have a partnership with the National Shooting Sports Foundation, Secure the Stores, in which we're talking to the licensees about that, about trying to do, you know, what they can do to harden their target, to harden their stores up. There are no federal regulations requirements for security in a shop. The requirements are all on licensing and requirements for the records they need to keep and what they need to do. Every FFL is required, when they have a theft or a burglary, they're required to contact ATF as well as their local police department. But there are no requirements in the regs as far as security. So, you know, that's an opportunity for a conversation with these folks. We do that through seminars and meetings and, you know, just one-on-one conversations. I have a supervisor that's out in one of the Pittsburgh offices, and he's an avid hunter. So he was recently, you know, he was out bear hunting, and every, you know, when he goes out to his camp, there's a licensee that he drives by all the time, kind of out in the middle of nowhere. So he decided to just stop by one day and you know, strike up a conversation with the owner and get to know them. And during that conversation, he asked, you know, well, what do you, you know, you're kind of out here in the middle of nowhere. What do you do as far as security? And that gentleman's response was, well, you know, I lock the doors, but basically, you know, that's what I have insurance for. So, you know, that's an extreme on one end, but that's the reason for the conversation. My office, the division office in Philadelphia, is right, you know, at the end of the street from Jewelers Row. And every night, that stuff is locked up tighter than you know what.
Are there bars over the windows?
Yeah, I mean, they put their product away. And it's not the exact same comparison, but so that's the opportunity to talk to these folks, what they can do on their end to improve that security, and suggestions from us.
I would hope that most gun store owners have a better attitude.
And they do.
That's why I have insurance, because right. It is not a normal product that is being stolen. You know, you mentioned straw purchases, and you know, very often when we've had this discussion of how to get guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them, we have heard that one of the ways that they get a gun on the street is through a straw purchase. You know, somebody who has a criminal background that's not supposed to own, by law, a gun, gets it through a straw purchaser. We've cracked down, I say we, meaning not only the state, but a lot of states have. I don't know about the feds, but have cracked down on straw purchases, tried to find a way to keep that from happening. I wonder if this increase in the number of burglaries has anything to do with cracking down on straw purchases.
Well, it's possible. I mean, we talk about that all the time, whether it's you know, street gangs or drug trafficking. When you focus your efforts in one area, it kind of squeezes out to others. So if you're able to chase a drug dealing gang out of one neighborhood, you know, they set up shop in another place. So there could be some of that. We just have to take the, you know, the view that we've got to do something on all those fronts. Mm-hmm. And having these conversations with the licensees about security and improving security. I mean, most of them do a fantastic job. This is something that we do now because we're seeing a lot more of these. One of the things we, on our industry side, is when we now get a report of a burglary or a robbery or theft from a licensee, we have an alert system that goes out to the surrounding counties. So it's an automated phone call that goes to the phone number of record for the other gun dealers in that area, and it basically just notifies them, hey, there's been a theft or burglary of firearms from a dealer in your area. And it's just as a reminder to, you know, take another look, tighten up security in your own place.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Hennessy, there's been a lot of attention over the past 2 weeks after the shooting at the high school in Parkland, Florida, about doing something about semi-automatic weapons, AR-15s in particular. But what guns are being stolen in these burglaries?
Typically, you're going to see the majority of the guns stolen are handguns. There are some rifles stolen as well, but the majority are handguns. And that's because they're easy to conceal on the street. They're easy to get rid of.
Mm-hmm. And that's where these guns end up, right?
On the street, yes.
Mm-hmm. The guns that have been stolen here in central Pennsylvania, have any of them been used in crimes that you've been able to tell since?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Like, can you give me some examples?
Well, I know that, for instance, there have been a couple of guns recovered outside of Pennsylvania. People have been car stopped carrying some of these firearms. Car stop is when a police officer pulls over a car for a traffic infraction or violation. And one reason or another, the person is found to have a firearm on them. There have been instances where that firearm has been linked back to some of these robberies. Another instance, we've seen recoveries in Baltimore. So, used in crimes, shootings, during the normal course of police business, they've been recovered. So, they're recovered in all different types of scenarios.
Well, and places too, I understand.
Yes.
Some of these burglaries, recent burglaries here in central Pennsylvania, we've heard that some of the guns have been recovered in Baltimore, but I understand it's not just Baltimore.
No, it's not. I mean, we always refer to Pennsylvania, it's kind of its own source state as far as straw purchasing for the criminal element. And that's the same as far as these burglaries and thefts, that there are guns from Pennsylvania robberies, burglaries that are being recovered in states around us. One of the tools we bring to bear on this is our use of the NIBIN system, the National Integrated Ballistics Information Network, and our crime gun intelligence centers. So what we do is we've got Philadelphia. We have a great program with the Philadelphia Police Department and a number of departments across the state, where every crime gun or every gun that's seized on the street is test fired and traced. So the tracing of the firearm is important because that goes back through.
And you're doing that by serial number, right?
We're doing it by serial number, model, make, and model. And that goes through the manufacturer, the distributor, and the retail, and then we go to the retail dealer and get the buyer's information. These are all leads for us in criminal investigations. The NIBIN system, what that allows us to do is the weapon is also test fired, and so that shell casing, the unique marks that are left by that firearm, are compared using the computer does the initial comparison. To the rest of the database that we have on other recovered crime guns. And we're able to link those guns to other incidents, which, number one, provides us other leads where this gun was used, other people to talk to in the course of our investigation. But also it may link an individual shooter with other crimes. And you know, like our director says, it's about going after the trigger pullers and the traffickers for us with firearms.
And actually, what this is a proposal over the years to stop guns from getting into the hands of people that shouldn't have them is that, but it's never really gone anywhere, is to do that test right from the very beginning, right before a gun, I guess once it comes out of the factory, do those ballistic tests, right?
Yes, that has been a...
But it's not the law.
It's not the law. Right. It's not the law.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about a rash of burglaries at gun stores here in central Pennsylvania and really throughout the country throughout 2017. Joining us today from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, Donald Robinson, Special Agent in Charge of the Philadelphia Field Office, and Charlene Hennessy, who's an ATF Special Agent and Public Information Officer. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Special Agent Hennessy, a question for you. We were talking about these guns being sold on the street. What kind of prices do they get on the street?
It could be just hundreds of dollars. They are sold a lot cheaper than you would buy them in the gun store because they want to offload them. They want to buy possibly drugs with the stolen firearms or other commodities on the streets.
So a gun that may go for $700, $800, $900 in a gun shop may be sold for $200.
Yeah, about that.
Yeah, you were going.
Times, yeah.
That's a little high for. Yeah.
Well, no, and it depends on the neighborhood. It depends on, you know, how hard it is to get. We've also seen where those prices are way above what you would get in a retail store. Mm. It's all going to depend on their circumstances in that area.
What right now is valuable on the street? I mean, are there guns that are sought out just because of the cachet, the reputation they have, or are most of the people buying these guns, they just want a gun?
Yeah, I never like to. I don't want to create a market for stolen firearms. So, you know, what we talked about before as far as the preference is usually for handguns. They're easily concealable. You know, if you're working a corner, as we say, slinging drugs or whatever, and you're trying to use that firearm for protection, generally a handgun is going to be of more use to you. It's you know, you can conceal that thing. So,
we had a call here from Dave in Lemoyne who asked, how do straw purchasers get away with it? Doesn't the firearm trace back to the original owner? If it's used in a crime, how can that be stopped?
Yes, it does. Yeah, and that's exactly what we do. When we get that, we do the trace, goes back to the dealer, and the dealer lets us know who that purchaser was. We go and interview the purchaser. And if it turns out to be a straw purchaser, then we're trying to, if we have information that purchase was made illegally, then we're trying to basically flip that person and move on. Straw purchasers, a lot of times, are folks that are, you know, they'll do whatever they can to make money. Whether that's, you know, a single mom or a young, you know, somebody that's 21 but doesn't have a criminal record, but they need money. And you know, so a lot of times they are victimized in that. There were some folks that would do it routinely, and they knew exactly what they were doing was illegal. So that's always the first step. We go to the retail purchaser, and if it happens to be a straw purchaser, then, you know, it's a full investigation. And we're ultimately trying to get to the person that is the final user, end user of the guns. There's a reason he or she can't buy the gun, and those are the folks we really want to get to.
So, you know, you talked about someone standing on a corner selling drugs. Are most of the people who are buying guns illegally involved in the drug trade?
From our perspective, illegal firearms are linked quite a deal with drug trafficking, and just violent crime on its own. You know, we've had plenty of investigations where it's, you know, if it's a gang investigation and it's all about turf and you know, their reputation and not even any drugs involved at all. But it's the violent acts, and they, you know, in today's world, unfortunately, folks view, you know, that having that weapon is a sign of power. So firearms are unfortunately, illegal firearms are unfortunately linked to drug trafficking in quite a few cases.
You mentioned gangs. Central Pennsylvania doesn't have a reputation like, say, a New York, a Chicago, even a Philadelphia, for having a large gang presence. I mean, we have gangs here, and from time to time they try to infiltrate the area. But from what I've seen of the arrest made for some of these burglaries that have occurred at gun shops in the past, a lot of them don't have Central Pennsylvania addresses, if they have addresses at all, but they're coming from New York, they're coming from Baltimore, they're coming from Philadelphia, larger cities. And there has been some talk that they are affiliated with gangs. Have you found that to be the case, a lot of these burglaries, that gangs are behind a lot of these burglaries?
I would. They're criminal organizations. They're groups that are that the firearm is a tool of their trade. So they're looking to get these. And hey, it's you know, Route 83 runs right up
from
Maryland
to Harrisburg,
right up into Pennsylvania. And the interstate system, as great as it is, it also aids those folks too. So now this portion of the like Philadelphia, this portion of the country doesn't have you don't see a lot of the. You know, the national gangs. But they've got
Chicago, LA, yeah, that's what we think
Latin
of.
Latin Kings or MS-13, the other stuff that we deal with in different parts of the country. But the neighborhood gangs are, you know, they're involved in the same activities. They may be a little bit less organized than a national gang, as far as the hierarchy and everything, but you know, it's still if they're making money. So violence is a way to enforce their law on the street. And to make money through the drugs.
But just kind of getting back to my original question, mm-hmm. Are many of these burglaries being committed gangs, organized crime?
I would say they're organized groups. Not all of them are gangs, but they're you know they're crews. I mean we're you know without talking about specific investigations, we're finding some of them may or may not have been committed by the same groups. So we're looking into that. We're following all that. I mean that's the case with almost anything. You know, if you've got something that's working, you're going to keep doing it. Mm. So, you know, we investigate every FFL burglary that occurs with our state and local counterparts. But ATF responds to every burglary.
Special Agent Hennessy, Special Agent Robinson mentioned that your office is right down the street from Jewelers Row in Philadelphia, where if anyone has, and it's not just Philadelphia, but any large city, a lot of jewelers that have bars out front. Many of these gun shops just look like a regular, you know, the plate glass windows right out front, and many of these burglaries have occurred, as described, just backing a truck or breaking that window. So what works? Have you found what works to keep a gun shop or a dealer safer from these kind of activities?
Well, we've actually partnered with the NSSF, the National Shooting Sports Foundation, and I mean we work with the industry to suggest safety precautions for these FFLs, whether it be bars, whether it be storing and locking their firearms away in safes rather than leaving them in the cases. Getting an alarm system, getting surveillance equipment. I mean, there's any number.
I would assume they have all those things.
You would
don't
assume,
they?
But it's
right.
not
all
always
them do?
The case.
Really?
No. Yes. And they're, I mean, for the most part, they're retailers. And we can't enforce any laws saying you must abide by these regulations because there are none. We can just make suggestions.
And I think that's, you know, like we talked about earlier, that's the opportunity for the conversation with these folks. Something as simple as running a cable through the trigger guards on rifles that are in a display case or something. And we're you know, it's a matter of balancing precautions that you need to take and being a burden on a legal commerce. This is legal in our country. So you want to balance that you know the level of work that's required on those things. So that partnership is about suggesting work with them, like simple ways to do it. Everybody understands the cost that can be involved in a lot of security measures, and we're just trying to work with them to figure out what's best for them. And the most important thing is to keep those guns from falling in the wrong hands.
You know, this conversation that we've had over the past 2 weeks about the mass shootings, and we've heard many people. I just had a show yesterday where we had some organizations representing educators talking about, you know, how students, parents, teachers, anyone, if they suspect something, what they could do. Same holds true here. If a gun shop owner, I mean, do they pay attention to their surroundings? If there is someone who is watching them or someone who is coming in and not buying anything?
Yeah. Sure they do.
Okay, so how do they go about that? Do they report that to you or what?
Either to us or to their local police department. I mean, we've had both happen. Or if they do get burglarized, we have talked to them previously. Have you experienced anything odd lately? Has anyone been in the shop asking a lot of questions? So, I mean, they Yes, they have reported it to us, but, you know, oftentimes they'll just report it to the local PD.
And by far, the majority of those folks are doing that. I mean, they get it. They don't want to. They don't want to be.
This
the
is
ones,
our business.
Yeah, yeah. They don't want to be the ones where we're coming in to talk to about, you know, something that occurred. And I've said this. I've been on the job for 30 years. We talk to the dealers about this all the time. None of them are required to make a sale. If there's something hinky or something funny about it, they don't. They're not required to. If there's something wrong, they just get that feeling. They don't have to make the sale. They can make a contact, even if it turns out to be nothing. You know, it's their business, and we want to support them. That's what our industry ops is all about, is helping them to maintain their records correctly and try and do that on that side. That's what this partnership is about. Further, you know, trying to provide them with some information. What can we do so that we can all together make those shops more secure, and that we have less of these burglars?
I want to move on to some other topics, but before we do, when we're talking about the dealers actually making some tips, Special Agent Hennessy, ATF has a tip line for regular citizens, everyone out there who may suspect, maybe not a gun burglar or gunshot burglary, but that someone is in possession of a gun illegally. What is that tip line? How can people make some tips to you?
Sure. They can call 1-888-ATF-GUNS when it's related to guns, ATF-FIRE when it's related to any information about a fire, or bomb if there's any information about someone having explosive device.
Now, is this just suspicions? I mean, obviously, if someone knows something concrete, they can make those tips. But do you have people contacting you with tips of just a suspicion they have?
Absolutely.
And how do you investigate that?
We assign it to a group, assign it to one of the supervisors. They'll assign it out to an agent, and they'll do some background check on it. They'll do some work on it. They'll contact the local police department, detectives in that area, see what they know about it. And there are times where we'll go and interview somebody. Today's world, nobody can afford to let things slip through the cracks. So we all work very hard. All the agencies work very hard to follow up on everything that comes into us. So those tips, if they go into the national hotline, they go out to the field division, and then are assigned from the field division out to the field office.
Mm. Want to move on to a couple other topics in the few minutes that we have left. Recently, a gun shop opened in Lancaster that's very close to the campus of Franklin and Marshall College, and there's a school nearby, too. Mm-hmm. The neighborhood has been, I hate to use the term up in arms, but they have been upset that this gun shop has moved into the area. Are there regulations, limitations where a gun shop can open?
Not under federal regulations, except that there is a requirement for licensees to comply with all local regulations and zoning. So anything that would be required by the local municipality or the state, they have to be in compliance with all those laws. But there are no federal regulations as far as where a business can be located.
Now, we know that schools have, there's gun-free zones, and what is that, 100 yards away from a school building?
I think it's 1,000 feet.
1,000 feet, okay. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that would limit some gun shops opening in the area, but it's, as far as no limitations, no regulations where, unless it's local, zoning, that kind of thing, no federal rules against where a gun shop can be located.
Because it's such a patchwork of regulations and zoning. I mean, just from one township to the next, they could have different requirements. So the requirement on the federal side is that you comply with all the local and state requirements. If they allow you to have that business there, then we will license it, and you'll be subject to the federal regulations as far as a licensee is required to do.
Has ATF ever been called before, like a zoning board or a borough council, city council, asking whether is it a good idea to put this gun shop in?
We've get questions all the time. Our industry ops folks, in fact, in this case, my division industry operations director responded back to a question that came on this on the shop and explained all of that in much more detail than we just discussed. But the requirements that are there and the background of that, the history of that.
I want to move on to something else in this debate that we're having about additional gun regulations since the last school shooting. I mean, it's been an ongoing conversation, but obviously it's at front and center for many people here in the last 2 weeks. And a lot of people are talking about universal background checks and that kind of thing. ATF does a lot of, well, maybe all of, you tell me, when it comes to background checks. What exactly do you do when it comes to providing information on someone who wants to purchase a firearm?
Well, the background checks are run through the NICS system, which is actually administered by the FBI because they've got the NCIC. So all those records checks are done through there. Pennsylvania is an instant check state, so that background check is done and their information is relayed back to the dealer. In those instances where, and they've got a certain number of days to reply to that, and if they don't hear back, then the dealer can go ahead and make the sale. There are several, you know, a small number of cases where the records check may take longer than that, and then the dealer is contacted and law enforcement may need to go out to talk to the purchaser if there's a problem after that initial period that the check is being done in. So, but we are responsible for investigating, cases involving folks that go in and falsify the forms. You know, there are people that, even knowing they have a felony conviction, they'll go in and try and do the paperwork anyway. So those cases get referred in Pennsylvania to the local police, the state police, and goes out to the local police. And then delayed denials are what I was talking about, where the record check took a little bit longer than the time that they're given, the sale's been made, and then we got to go out and talk to the buyer.
Final question, and I think that if you had the answers, then it would have been done sooner. But generally, how do we get illegal guns off the street?
I think it's just a concerted effort from all of us. It's not all about law enforcement. It takes everybody from the investigation side, from the licensing side, and just trying to do the right thing and making sure at home, making sure firearms are locked up, reporting information. I mean, it's just no one single thing is going to answer it be the single answer. I've been on this job for 30 years now, and worked under, different administrations throughout that history, laws come and go, and new suggestions come about. We enforce what's there. ATF is we take no position on any of the statutes or bills that are out there. If it becomes law, we'll enforce it, and we'll enforce it fairly.
I want to thank you very much for being with us today. Donald Robinson, Special Agent in Charge of the Philadelphia Field Office of the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, and Charlene Hennessy, ATF Special Agent and Public Information Officer. Thank you very much for being with
Thanks
us today.
Thanks a lot for Thank having you. Us. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. March 2nd, 1962, 56 years ago tomorrow, the Philadelphia Warriors' Wilt Chamberlain scored 100 points against the New York Knicks in a game that was played at what was then called the Hershey Arena, now today Hershey Park Arena. Chamberlain's 100-point game set a pro basketball record that stands to this day. Many people outside of Central PA don't realize the game was played in Hershey. Today we speak with two men, who one has written about it, and another man was there to witness Wilt Chamberlain's record-setting effort and has a few stories to tell. Joining us is Gary Pomerantz, who is author of several successful books, including the book Wilt 1962. Mr. Pomerantz, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be on with you. Thanks.
And you're in San Francisco, so I'm glad that you got up early to talk with us today. James Haney was at the Wilt Chamberlain's 100-point game 56 years ago and now lives in Camp Hill, has some souvenirs from that game. Mr. Haney, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Nice to be here.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Maybe there's someone else out there who was at that game. Gary Pomerantz, let's talk about this game. I mean, as I said, so many people across the country don't realize that that game was played in Hershey rather than in Philadelphia. And there was a sparse crowd in Hershey that night, but so many people since then have claimed that they actually witnessed the game and attended it. So I understand that when you talk to someone who says they're there, you actually have a little test for them.
Well, there's a lot. Everyone claimed to have been there, of course. I mean, this was a major moment in American sports. The 100-point game by Wilt Chamberlain was really a hyperbolic announcement of the ascendancy of the black superstar in professional basketball. People don't realize it today, but, today the NBA is a glitzy showcase. And back then, it was a bit of a lounge act. I mean, it used to be said that the crowds were so small that the PA announcers before the game would introduce the players, and then they'd introduce each of the fans who were there. and so what they were trying to do was to develop new fans. The league only had nine teams that year, only one west of St. Louis, or the Mississippi, and that was the Los Angeles Lakers. So they were trying to develop new fans in outlying areas, and they would go to places that had big arenas, such as Hershey, which had an arena of more than 8,000. 4,124 was the official count that night. Even that might have been inflated. No one is quite sure because a number of the boys in Hershey snuck in for free.
Yeah, that's what I understand. I mean, a lot of people talking about even where the ball went afterwards and all that, the last ball where Wilt scored the 100 points. So let's talk about that game in particular. I mean, obviously 100 points, such a milestone. But what was different about that game that allowed Wilt Chamberlain to get to the 100-point mark?
Well, this was the joy for me in writing Wilt 1962, just the going inside this moment that had been forgotten. It was like, raising a Spanish galleon from the ocean floor 40 years later. And I interviewed 15 of the men who played in that game, and all 56 people who were at the Hershey Arena that night. And again, remember, this is more than 40 years later. What made that game so different was, a few things. One, it was played in a small town such as Hershey. Two, Wilt Chamberlain, who was a notoriously awful free throw shooter, converted 28 of 32 free throws, shooting them underhanded. It was almost like an adult sitting in a kindergartner's chair in school. He would bend down low, his knees would flare out. He looked rather ridiculous doing it, but he made them. And this was at the end of a season. The Knicks were a last-place team, and one of their centers, who was 6'10", a good size to match up against the 7'1" Chamberlain, didn't play that game because, he'd gone out on a bender the night before, and he just couldn't make it out of the hotel in Harrisburg, the Hotel Penn Harris, and so that was Phil Jordan. So the Knicks were one man short, and he was 6'10". For much, the man who played against Chamberlain that night, Daryl Imhoff, committed 6 fouls and fouled out after playing just 20 minutes. So that meant for 28 minutes of that 48-minute game, the Knicks did not have a player taller than 6'8". That meant Chamberlain had a 5-inch advantage. That's a lot. And so the Knicks were being humiliated as Chamberlain's score was rising, his total, 80 points, 90 points. And they were surrounding him, 4 and 5 men. They would let anybody else score. They just didn't want anyone to be talking about this game and their humiliation 56 years later.
Well, who did cover? If Imhoff fouled out, who did cover Chamberlain for most of the night?
Well, they were shuttling men around. Johnny Green, who was 6'6", and Cleveland Buckner, 6'7", and Dave Budd, 6'7". They had no one. They had no one, and it was, this was a different time in the NBA. In this game, you had a few former Marines. You had first-generation American players. You had one teammate of Wilt's, Tom Mascheri, whose father was from Russia, who had fought against the Bolsheviks in the Russian Revolution. Very different from the NBA today.
Well, James Haney now lives in Camp Hill and attended the game and has actually mentioned in Gary Pomerant's book, Wilt 1962, several times. Mr. Haney, I have to say that a friend of yours kind of got the ball rolling on having this segment of the program, but the other day I saw some of the memorabilia you have, including a program from that game, but you have a few stories of your own of this game, but you realized as a basketball fan, just what Gary had talked about, that Wilt was making his foul shots that night.
Yeah,
but what do you remember, just kind of overall, what sticks out to you about that game?
What sticks out to me was that Wilt was making his fouls. Also, Guy Rogers was feeding him every time down the floor. And they just couldn't stop him. And people were yelling and, go, we didn't think too much. I thought much about it till we got like hit 80 or something, and people started saying, hey, what we got going on here? And then they were announcing 98 and 100, and then everybody cheered and a kid ran on the floor. But that what got me was just that Wilt was making his fouls and he was getting the ball every time down. In fact, I think he scored like over 30 points in the last quarter. And they didn't play much defense. And the score was 169 to 147.
Yeah, it sounds like an all-star game to score in the NBA today. But, one thing that you point out when you said that they were announcing how many points that Chamberlain had is that you go to an NBA game today, even a college game, and even a high school game, they'll keep running track of how many points the players have. But they didn't do that back in those days, or at least not in Hershey. So it's a good thing that the announcer was making those announcements. I'm sure the Knicks really appreciated that as well.
Yeah, especially Richie Guerin.
Well, yeah, you have some stories to tell. Yeah. Richie Guerin, now he was a guard, right?
Yeah, but I think he was like 6'4". But he looked small on the court, compared to Wilt and everybody. So I had great seats, like the second row.
Yeah, well, explain how you got those good seats.
Well, I was a young guy, about 22, and I had two guys, friends of mine, with me. We were going to the game, and we got the initial tickets were up in nosebleeds and seats. So I went down to the bowels of the stadium and asked the promoter, I said, look, I'm a salesman, I got two clients with me, can I get better seats? And the guy said, well, here. So he gave me three tickets that were right on like the second row across from the bench. It was really a great seats. And the funny thing was, I think and of course, in those days, you got dressed up. I had a suit and tie on. And,
so you look like a salesman.
Right, and I'm 6'2", and so I'm standing courtside. I think it was like after the Eagles played the Baltimore Colts. They were the Baltimore Colts.
Yeah, an exhibition game beforehand, football
beforehand.
Games.
So a young kid comes up to me and says, are you a basketball player? I said, yes. He said, would you sign my program? I said, sure. So I signed his program, Jim Haney, and so other kids see that. All of a sudden I got about six or eight kids lined up, and I'm signing my name, and my two friends are laughing and everything, and so we didn't think any of it, but to me, I got to thinking about it, when I was talking to Gary, So now if everyone kept their program like I did, those kids are going to have that program, and the trivia question of the century would be, okay, I know who Guy Rogers is. I know who the hell is this Jim Haney?
Not to mention that you ruined the value of those
exactly,
programs today.
Exactly. Sorry about that.
But, and by the way, just to make sure that everyone knows this, you weren't a salesman, right?
Right. That's
yeah.
I was going to college at the time.
Yeah, so you were just a young you were just a young guy who decided you needed better seats.
That's right, exactly.
So now every sporting event, and anyone hears this, they're going to try the same thing. I don't know if that will work or not.
Well, I use some of my New Jersey street skills.
So, Gary, obviously this is something that will be remembered forever. Will anyone approach? I mean, I know there have been players who have approached 100 points, but do you think anyone will ever score 100 in a game again?
Well, the closest so far is Kobe Bryant, who scored 81 points in a game. Kobe is not a center. He did it with some three-point shooting. Wilt did not have the advantage of the three-point shot. And by the way, when people think of Wilt Chamberlain, they often think of the old Wilt Chamberlain, muscled up, playing for the Lakers with his yellow headband. And they forget that once upon a time, like 1962, for instance, there was a different Wilt Chamberlain who was, you know, 7'1", 260 pounds. He ran the floor like a train, and he was out on the fast break. These weren't all slam dunks. These were shots from all over the floor. I think it could happen because of the three-point shot and because we're starting to see so many players in the NBA, well, not so many, but a few, like Kevin Durant, for instance, of the Golden State Warriors, nearly 7 foot tall and able to convert three-point shots. So, you know, if all the stars align, it could happen, but certainly it's unlikely.
And I think that's a great point, though. It's not the same game since Wilt did not have when he had a three-point shot, it was the old-fashioned way where he scored two and then was fouled and made a free throw afterwards.
Right, and in that lane, Scott, was only 12 feet wide. Now it's been expanded to 15, in part because of the dominance of Wilt. And when it was just 12 feet wide, Wilt could stand just outside the key, you know, right where they now have the block painted. They didn't have it painted on the floor then, down low. The teammate would pass him the ball, and he could take one lunging step, and he's right at the basket. You can't do that when it's wide.
Some great memories, and I have your book, Gary, so, you know, great book, great read, great memories. Gary Pomerantz, author of the book Wilt 1962. Jim Haney was at the game, and you heard his story, so if you have a program signed by Jim Haney, I hate to ruin how much you think that's worth. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to be on.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Spring is only 20 days away, and you can get in the spirit this weekend at the Pennsylvania Garden Show of York, at the York Expo Center, at Memorial Hall on the York Fairgrounds. Joining us to talk a little bit more about it is Cher Condor. She's with the Pennsylvania Garden Show of York. Cher, welcome back to the program. Whoops, I guess
thank
I better.
You, Scott.
There you go.
Happy to be on.
Okay, so the garden show starts today, and for a lot of people, I know that they look at this and they say, okay, the long winter is almost over. This is our opportunity to go and see some flowers, see some beauty, see some projects that are you know, that we can work on around our house this summer, I should say. So a lot of people, that's what they come out for, is they want to get in that spring spirit, right?
That's right. The show opens on Friday and runs through Sunday, so March 2, 3, and 4. And, you know, with all the crazy stuff happening today, people can go into a survival mode where it sort of becomes like fear porn. But life should be about balance and hope and fullness and enjoyment. So the PA Garden Show of York's theme this year is Just Imagine, because it gives a place to kickstart that notion that spring is coming. There is revival and hope and the place to start considering the best things for you and your family. Plus, there's practical ways to make life better of improving the home living space.
You know, did I say today? I have my days mixed up the week. That even I do that. I'm thinking today's Friday, and now I just ruined it for myself because I realized that today is Thursday. Oh. But it does open tomorrow. So, what are some of the exhibits? Some of the things that those who venture to the garden show can see?
Well, we have a balanced show. It consists of display gardens, and there's some really wonderful things going in there. Yesterday, I saw they were tuning up a working fountain at the Meadowview Gardens that consisted of it was a tree made out of hand-hewn copper. So but it was a little maple tree. You know how they have the little stylized maple tree. So this one, every leaf was handcrafted, and then water runs through that so that the effect is rain dripping off all the leaves. And right now it's a bright copper color, but it will age as it goes on in its life cycle. So that's pretty cool. You can look for that. Cross Creek Farm, which consistently wins Best of Show in the People's Choice Awards, has come up with their own version of a she shed, which is really cool. And they always have, just different kinds of water features and fountains. It's fun. It's whimsical. And Carol Bupp will be talking from Cross Creek Farm, will be talking about how she remanages all the old junk and makes it into beautiful and useful items. So that's a big thing now. So we have a couple big speakers coming in, including Jan Bills, who has a landscaping company called Two Women and a Hoe, and she's all about reconnecting with nature and making gardening fun.
Hey, Cher, can I interrupt for just a moment, because I'm almost out of time, and there will be many seminars there as well. Go to your website on the seminars on the WITF stage at York Expo Center Memorial Hall. Cher Condor, I want to thank you very much. One last time, real quick, when does the show open and the hours?
Show opens Friday at 10 to 8, Saturday 10 to 8, and Sunday 10 to 5. It's pagsy.com. And it's how we welcome spring.
Thank you very much, Cher Condor.